Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting, leaving more than 200 dead in its wake across the Caribbean. Hurricane Matthew now barreling toward Florida with potentially catastrophic winds. 2 million people across the southeast United States have been told to flee inland. It's the most powerful storm to threaten the U.S. Atlantic coast in more than a decade. Florida Governor Rick Scott warning residents it's monstrous and life-threatening storm.
If you're reluctant to evacuate, just think of all the people this storm has already killed. You and your family could be among these numbers if you don't take this seriously.
Millions of people in Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina were told to evacuate their homes, and interstate highways were turned into one-way routes to speed up the exodus. Florida alone accounted for about 1.5 million people told to clear out. Many boarded up their homes and businesses and left at the mercy of the storm. Like thousands of other Americans, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton abruptly upended their plans in Florida Thursday, where Hurricane Matthew continues to threaten havoc in the final stretch of the presidential campaign in a crucial state. Campaigns rushed to move staff and volunteers, close offices, and cancel events in the path of the storm. And as many Floridians heeded calls to evacuate, both candidates began the delicate task of pursuing votes during a crisis. Hillary Clinton's campaign asked the state of Florida to extend voter registration, though the governor denied that request. Both candidates are also preparing for their second debate, which will be held this Sunday in a town hall-style format in St. Louis, Missouri. This is VOA. The UN envoy for Syria called on al-Qaeda-linked militants to leave the embattled city of Aleppo in exchange for an end to government and Russian bombardment, warning Thursday that thousands of civilians could be killed and the historic city destroyed by year end if conditions don't change soon.
We're looking at over 16,000 people have been displaced in Haiti alone. The key needs at this point are shelter, clean water, sanitation facilities. The health concerns regarding waterborne illnesses are absolutely something we're keeping a close eye on.
And that was, of course, referring to the hurricane. Here's Stefan Di Mistura.
In maximum 2 months, 2.5 months, the city of Eastern Aleppo, at this rate, may be totally destroyed.
Di Mistura entreated both sides to look at my eyes before offering to personally escort the fighters to a refuge of their choosing, provided they agree to lay down their arms. He says the combined Syrian government and Russian bombardment of the city's rebel-held east has killed 376 people over the last 2 weeks. He also called for the local administration in opposition-held eastern neighborhoods to remain in place after Fatah al-Sham leaves, with the UN establishing a presence there to bring humanitarian supplies to the besieged population. The UN Security Council has formally endorsed Portugal's former Prime Minister, António Guterres, as the next UN Secretary General. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports.
In a rare show of unity, the 15 UN Security Council members coalesced around the 67-year-old former prime minister and former head of the UN Refugee Agency, unanimously endorsing him to lead the organization when Ban Ki-moon's term expires at the end of this year. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin, who heads the council this month, announced the result of the formal vote.
He's a high-level politician. He has been the prime minister of his country, and he is a person who talks to everybody, listens to everybody, speaks his mind, very outgoing, I think, open person. So I think it was a great choice.
Next week, the UN General Assembly is expected to give his appointment the final approval. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Texas state agents raided the Dallas headquarters of adult classified ad portal Backpage and arrested its chief executive officer, Carl Ferrer, on Thursday, following allegations that adult and child sex trafficking victims had been forced into prostitution through escort ads posted on the site. Ferrer was arrested on a California warrant after arriving at Houston's Bush International Airport on a flight from Amsterdam. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bhatti in Washington. Today is Friday, October 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Doctors at government hospitals in Sudan went on strike yesterday, Thursday.
Three basic demands: that they improve the environment of work, that they provide a training for the doctors, and that they provide the basic needs for patients, especially in the ER, in the emergency room.
Mariam Al-Mahdi is a pediatrician and also the first woman vice president of the main opposition National Umar Party. A newspaper publisher in Sudan says he and his staff have been punished by the government for reporting the news. A South Sudan delegation says its recent visit to the United States was successful. And Zambia's main opposition leader is free on bail after denying charges of sedition.
They were charged with two offenses, one unlawful assembly and the other one seditious practices. They have denied the charges and granted bail of 25,000 Zambian kwacha as currency.
Charles Kakoma is a spokesman for Zambia's main opposition UPND party. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe opened a new session of parliament yesterday, Thursday, and Kenya develops a TB treatment for children. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Doctors at government hospitals in Sudan began a nationwide strike yesterday, Thursday, to press home their demands for higher wages, better medical facilities, and protection from security forces. 37 of the country's major hospitals, 17 of them in the capital Khartoum, have been affected by the strike. Sudan's Minister of Health has reportedly referred to the doctors as politicized, who only want to embarrass the government at a time when the government is engaged in a national dialogue with the opposition to determine the future of the country. But Mariam Al-Mahdi, a pediatrician and also the first woman vice president of the main opposition National Umar Party, says the doctors had no choice but to strike.
The doctors have convened 3 days ago on the 3rd of October and called the State Ministry of Health for certain demands, basically three basic demands: that they improve the environment of work, that they provide a training for the doctors, and that they provide the basic needs for patients, especially in the ER, in the emergency rooms. And they have given the State Ministry of Health 48 hours to respond positively to their demand, or they will go in a strike until their demands are met, because they have been facing the violence of the needy patients who come to the emergency seeking help for very acute cases like breathlessness, problem with breathing, bleeding, or such things. They cannot provide for them anything, because in many emergency rooms, there is no even oxygen cylinder. So today, which is the day of the deadline of the warning given by the doctors, they went in strike. They have stopped working in cold cases and in the inpatient department, but they kept on, of course, seeing needy people in the emergency room.
What are the main reasons that the doctors are protesting for? What are their concerns?
Their concerns are basically that they don't have any ability to provide the minimum proper medical assistance to patients. They have a very poor work environment. They don't have any protection. The salaries are very poor. They get something like less than $200 per month for intern doctors, and it doesn't exceed double that even for the specialized ones. And they don't get any training in a fixed way. It is very much limited to the money abilities and so on. So there is no proper training given to these doctors. Now, above that, there is no legal protection for them against the violence of people.
What do you say to people who say, well, you are the doctors, your job is to treat us, to make us well? If you don't treat us, then you are not doing your professional duty.
True. These demands has been adamantly and persistently presented by the doctors. The health sector is totally abandoned, is totally neglected. So the doctors have been insisting on not going into this step because, as you said, they don't want to leave the patients not protected by not providing them any health. But it is actually now they can't certainly do anything, and the people is taking their rightful anger of not finding the proper medical help at the doctors themselves. They are hitting them, they are smashing the emergency rooms, and it is now reached the point of explosion. That's why it is about time, actually, for the doctors to be truthful to themselves, to be ethical to their patients, is to stop, because they are there in a place called the hospital with no provision to give any help or to cure any disease.
Has there been any response from the Sudanese government to the doctors' request or demands?
First of all, as I said, the state minister, who is the one who has been now the icon of confrontation with his colleagues, doctors, for the last several years. He has been in full protection from any questioning. He came in the out yesterday. He said there is no problem. There is no need for any changes. These doctors are only politicized, exploited people who want to embarrass the government in this very critical time where people are going to the national dialogue, or they are calling for conclusion of national dialogue and such things.
Mariam Al-Mahdi is a pediatrician and also the first woman vice president of the main opposition National Umar Party. She was speaking with me from the capital, Khartoum. The editor-in-chief of the Khartoum-based Al Jarida daily newspaper says Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Service agents have punished him and his staff for reporting the news, forcing them into economic hardship. Security agents confiscated more than 10,000 copies of the paper's Tuesday edition this week, but offered no explanation for their action. Nabil Biagio reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's National Intelligence and Security Service, or NISS, confiscated 10,200 copies of Al Jarida newspaper on Tuesday. The editor-in-chief of Al Jarida, Ashraf Abdulazim, says the NISS decision to confiscate copies of his paper has cost him and his staff thousands of Sudanese pounds.
The National Intelligence and Security Service means to punish newspapers and impede journalistic work by causing economic losses so that we do more on self-censorship on our editorial pieces.
Abdulazim says, despite several attempts to contact NISS personnel to understand why the papers were confiscated, authorities have refused to communicate with them. Abdulazim says NISS personnel are known for quashing articles that are critical of the government.
I have courageous writers that do investigative journalism and work about issues that concern the common people and challenge the government to do more to improve people's life.
Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says journalists should be afforded a certain degree of freedom and NISS should not seize papers to censor them.
We are going to the national dialogue end on the 10th, and then a lot of laws are going to be amended, the margin of the freedom and the press and these things will be very big.
But Bilal asserts that certain topics will remain off limits to journalists.
I can't say people can speak about the army, about the national security, about these things. Things are going to be improved.
The seizure of Al Jarida papers comes one day after the NISS confiscated copies of a Siha newspaper. Again, security operatives offered no explanation. Journalists in Sudan say NISS doesn't like them criticizing the government, talking about state-sponsored corruption, the wars in Darfur and South Kordofan, among other sensitive topics. Journalists often are forced to employ self-censorship as a survival tactic. There have been numerous confiscations of leading Sudanese newspapers this year by security operatives. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, October 7th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says the visit to the United States by a delegation led by First Vice President Taban Deng-Gai was one of the most successful visits ever taken by a South Sudanese leader since the 2013 conflict. Taban Deng Gai attended last month's UN General Assembly on behalf of President Kiir. He and his delegation were in Washington this week. Presidential spokesman Atain Wek Atain says the delegation met with State Department officials and members of Congress, although he did not say specifically which U.S. official the delegation met with. But Atain says the treatment the delegation received indicates there is a rapprochement between South Sudan and the United States.
The visit of the first vice president and his delegation is one of the most successful visits ever taken by a South Sudanese leader since the eruption of conflict in December 15, 2013.
When you say one of the most successful visits, what message did you bring for the thousands of South Sudanese here in the United States?
Well, our first audience are American before South Sudanese, because most of South Sudanese are at home. And what we tell the South Sudanese who are actually in the diaspora, it would not be anything we say, you know, just saying, but, you know, we will do actions that will be seen by the diaspora and, you know, as discouraging. But for the Americans, we have engaged them. The first vice president was able to deliver a very meaningful speech at the General Assembly in New York. And later on, he went and attended Atlantic Council, that is a think tank. And also, he met a number of government officials from the State Department and the Congress. And that's the engagement that, you know, it never happened since 2013. The general situation is that, you know, there is a rapprochement between the Republic of South Sudan and United States of America.
You are here at a time that there are reports of renewed fighting, particularly Ye River State. And some people say that perhaps the only way to free South Sudan of this continuing violence is for President Salva Kiir to step down. First of all, what did you hear from the Americans that you met with? What did they tell you?
Well, the Americans have no intention to let President Salva Kiir end, you know, his tenure. The Americans wanted peace agreement to be implemented by none other than President Salva Kiir himself. You know, for those who talk about President Salva Kiir, you know, leaving power, they are dreaming. President Salva Kiir came to power through an election that was interrupted in 2013, but yet peace agreement renewed the tenure of President Salva Kiir until 2018, when he will be going to General Assembly. The other part of your question, you talk about fighting which has taken place in Ye River. You know, the fighting which has taken place is between our forces and the bandits. These are not groups that belong to any, you know, political military organization. The SPLM-IO, under the leadership of the current first vice president, is a true peace partner to the Sudan People Liberation Movement government. And so the forces of the SPLM-IO are not fighting the government. So who are fighting? These are disgruntled members of the SPLM-IO that are supporters of Dr. Riak and the bandits, who are even fighting for a cause that is not known completely, because they only kill civilians.
My understanding is that most South Sudanese in this country, the United States, reside in Nebraska. Did you visit that state, and what did the people there tell you?
You know, we have not gone to Nebraska. We have not gone to other states apart from Washington, D.C. and New York City, where United Nations and the government of United States, you know, reside respectively. We didn't go because the purpose of coming to United States was not to campaign and go to every household that is inhabited by South Sudanese abroad. We came here for United Nations meeting and to engage the American government, which we have done successfully.
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from New York City. The presidential candidate of Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, and his vice presidential nominee in the August 11 elections have been granted bail. Hakainde Hichilema and Jeffrey Mwamba were arrested and charged Wednesday with sedition and unlawful assembly. Zambian police say the opposition leader and his deputy addressed an impromptu gathering of UPND supporters in Mpongwe, a rural town, without a permit, which they said was illegal. The opposition leaders denied the charges. UPDN spokesman Charles Kakoma says the charges against the two-party leaders were politically motivated and intended to embarrass them.
They were arrested yesterday, and they were charged with two offenses, one unlawful assembly and the other one seditious practices. Those are cases which are minor offenses. The police could have granted the police bond, but the police are so scared of the authorities, they could not give them police bond yesterday. So they slept themselves. This morning they were supposed to appear in court, but they failed to take them to court in the morning until the later in the afternoon when the director of public prosecution, they allowed them to take them to court. So they have been denied the charges and given a bail, granted bail of 25,000 kwacha, Zambian kwacha as currency, and two working sureties.
When do they go back to court?
Well, it is not yet clear when they are going back to court, but they will be informed on when they are going back to court.
Well, some people are saying that indeed they called on their supporters not to respect the authority and the election of Edgar Lungu. And because of that, that could have created or that could create tension and unnecessary political and possibly security instability based on their utterances. And that is where they were charged for those offenses. What is your reaction to that?
Well, what Kayinde Islem and Godfrey Waramamba have been saying is that this issue of the election of the president is a matter that they are pursuing in the courts of law in Zambia. They are challenging the election of President Lungu, that he did not win the election, and therefore they do not recognize him. And from their point of view, they cannot say, now we say he was duly elected and they recognize him, and then go to court to challenge his election. That would defeat their argument and the cost of justice. And they are saying, because we've taken this matter to court, we don't recognize him, and because he was not duly elected.
Now, but if I may
and
ask
also,
you...
So, the part of the unlawful assembly, they were just going to buy some things from the market to take to some of our leaders that have been arrested and taken to courts on the court. And when they were buying some things at the market, some people, of course, they are public figures, they are well known, they came to greet them. And that is what they were saying was an unlawful assembly.
But the government says that it has the constitutional mandate to protect Zambians, and therefore the calls by Hakainde Hichilema and Geoffrey Mwamba are meant to stoke tension, create political instability, and thereby create a situation whereby there will be a unity government and Hakainde Hichilema will be involved in such. Is this the case?
It appears like they are just scared of the unknown. They are imagining that that is what the opposition, that is what Hakainde is doing. But that is far from it. Hakainde is peacefully and he is in a civil way pursuing the matter legally in the court of law. And in the court of law, that is exactly how he is ordained to argue, that he was not duly elected. And therefore, there is nothing that he is doing that is illegal or promoting lawlessness in this country.
Charles Kakoma is a spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Lusaka. President Robert Mugabe addressed the new session of Zimbabwe's parliament yesterday, Thursday. All eyes were on the 92-year-old leader, watching for clues to the state of his health and listening for any response he might give to the recent protests against his government. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare.
President Mugabe, looking visibly tired, started proceedings by joking with his officials that they had given him the correct speech this time. The president stared, talk of mental decline a year ago when he reread a speech he had delivered in parliament a month before. This year, he read out a list of laws that his government wants parliament to amend or introduce to be in line with Zimbabwe's 2013 constitution and to prop up the country's moribund economy. Mugabe ended his speech by saying,
"In conclusion, I wish to remind you, honorable members of parliament, of your sacrosanct duty to enact laws and build institutions that promote development in an environment of peace and national unity. You not only have the duty to enact laws, but to also respect and adhere to them. and to our constitution in word, deed, and spirit.
Zimbabwe opposition MPs who had received death threats amid reports that they planned to protest while Mugabe spoke remained subdued throughout the 30-minute speech. Since July, the opposition has teamed up with civic organizations to hold protests against Mugabe and his 36-year rule of Zimbabwe. They accuse his government of failing to fix the economy and disregarding human rights. Authorities have used force to disperse the demonstrations or prevent protesters from gathering to march. On Thursday, Mugabe also said he wanted tighter laws to avoid what he called leakages in strategic areas of the Zimbabwean economy, such as mining and tourism. Leakage is when businesses do not declare their actual profits, depriving the country of tax revenue. The problem has plagued the government for the past decade since the discovery of diamond fields in eastern Zimbabwe and the takeover of the fields by the military. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Tuberculosis is one of the most dangerous and deadly diseases in the world. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control estimates about one-third of the world's population has the disease, and it was responsible for 1.5 million deaths in 2014. In Kenya, fighting the disease in children just became easier thanks to a new drug that hit the market this month. VOA's Kevin Enoch has this report compiled with the help of Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi.
Kenya is the first nation in the world to introduce a TB treatment specifically for children. The flavored drugs are administered free of charge, dissolve easily in water, and ensure kids get the correct dosage.
Feeding children is an uphill task. Feeding children who are sick is even a more uphill task. And so mixing the medicine with their food meant that if the food was not eaten, then the medicine was not taken. That meant that children were getting inaccurate doses.
Inaccurate dosing contributed to unnecessary deaths and drug-resistant TB.
We know that drug-resistant TB is a huge problem, and that's why organizations like TB Alliance, where we're developing new drugs and new regimens to fight drug resistance. And we want to make sure that these products get into the hands are developed for children as well as we move forward.
Kenyan health officials told VOA the government will do everything it can to make sure the drugs get to the kids who need them. But in parts of Kenya and other parts of the world, access to medical care and getting a correct diagnosis are challenges just as daunting as fighting the disease. Kevin Enoch, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Armed attackers believed to be members of Al-Shabaab have attacked a residential housing area in the Kenyan town of Mandera near the border with Somalia. Governor of Mandera County, Ali Uruba, confirmed the attack on Twitter. He said six people were killed and one other person was seriously injured. An American researcher was killed in Ethiopia after protesters began throwing rocks at the car she was riding in. Officials from the University of California, Davis, said Sharon Gray was a postdoctoral researcher with the plant biology department at the university. And that's it for this Friday, October 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, for Nicole Beckford, who is on today, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everybody a very good weekend.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC. Right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.
Her lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time
with David Bandy.